Hi, McCartney fans, and welcome to another edition of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi, and with me, as always, is my partner in crime and my backwards traveler. He is Andy Nichols. Andy, what's going on, my friend?
Morning, Tom. Good morning, and excited to be here for episode 96 with a
96,
great,
yes,
with a great guest today.
Yes, absolutely. Today, as you can see, we have ourselves a music journalist legend. He has written for New Musical Express, and he's also written for Q, Mojo, and Time Out, just to name a few. He's also written over a dozen books, including Bob Marley, The Untold Story, Jimmy Page, the definitive biography, and also this one, which we'll be talking about a little bit later as well. It's called McCartney, the Definitive Biography, not to be confused with the other Chris's book, The Definitive Biography from 1984. But we have with us Chris Selovich. Chris, how are you doing? Thank you for being here.
Selovich, we like to do it.
Selovich, thank you. I was practicing all night last night, Selovich, and then now I'm...
No, very happy to be here. Thanks very much. It's a sunny afternoon here in London.
Great. I'm glad to hear that. Before we get started into all your McCartney stuff, can you tell us a little bit about your background? Give us, up till maybe you started writing the McCartney book. Talk to us a little bit about your journalist experience up to that time.
Okay. Well, really, I just left. The NME at that point, well, about three years probably before I started writing it. Okay. And I worked for the NME from 74 to 81. I'd done English literature at university with the intention of becoming a journalist, but then realizing, you know, that I didn't really want to work for kind of, you know, I mean, the additional in the end, I try and get a, you know, and the NME, the New Musical Express, was coming up as a kind of very happening publication in the mid 70s, and I wanted to be identified with them. They seemed to give you a lot of space to write. You could write in a fairly subjective manner. At that point, I was very influenced by what Tom would call the new journalism. And in fact, I'd actually been turned on to the whole idea of doing journalism through reading the Tom Wolfe articles, which were published in the Daily Telegraph, which came out on Fridays. And there were his articles about the new London. And we'd get those in our a school library, and we had a free period on Friday mornings. So I read all, well, this is fantastic. I didn't realize you could do it like this. This is a whole new way of looking at things. And then, you know, that whole, the sort of style of writing in Rolling Stone or underground press here, like International Times, really influenced me. So... Mm-hmm. That's why, really, in the end, I wanted to write for the NME. I'd written for a magazine called Letter, this intelligent monthly, and had worked on Time Out, but I'm still doing stuff on Time Out, etc. But that's how I came to this, and I was actually in New York. I was doing a piece for the Sunday Times magazine about who'd just done a film with Harvey Keitel called, I can't remember what it's called actually. I was running a piece for, can't remember the title. I was running a piece for the Sunday Times about this and met my first agent, a woman called Karen Moline. And I'd already written a book about the Pretenders. Okay. And essentially, we got a deal to write a book about Paul McCartney for St. Martin's Press in New York, in America.
Okay, so you already had
this came about.
Okay, so you already had the the book deal signed before you even started writing the book. So yeah, you're able to start
they'd liked the book I'd written about the Pretenders.
Okay.
Which I'd done very quickly, but actually I'd had a lot of research in it. And the Beatles were the first group that I'd ever seen. You know, I'd been to see the Beatles end of April, I think it was 63.
Oh, wow.
Leeds Queen's Hall.
Excellent.
Co-bill topping with Acca Bilk and his Paramount Jazz Band. And I thought it was sensational. It really was the first gig I ever went to.
Wow.
And I went with my mate.
So were you able to see them again after that, or was it just the one time?
No, that was the only time I ever saw them. But it was just before it went crazy, you know?
Okay.
So you could actually hear them, you know?
Gotcha.
It was people screaming.
Was this before or after the Profumo affair?
It's about that time.
Okay.
It was about then, because From Me to You was number one. It just come out.
Right.
So it's about that time.
Okay. Interesting.
Why do you ask about the Profumo affair?
Because I lived in the UK for quite a while. I lived in Liverpool for 2 years, and my tutor over there always felt that the arrival of the Beatles was a nice masquerade over the over the Profumo affair. And it drew the attention away from that scandal.
That's probably correct. I'd never really thought of that. And I'm interested in the Profumo affair because I knew Lucky Gordon, who was one of Christine Keeler's lovers. And in fact, I wrote his obituary in the Guardian, actually, of 2 or 3 years ago. So I did have some knowledge of this. And also, I've worked with Chris Blackwell, who then employed Lucky Gordon. Mm. Chris Blackwell, who had Island Records. Yeah. This is a completely record. Obviously, you didn't ask me.
No, no, it's fine. No, I just was curious. That was always an interesting angle that was explained to me, and that's why I was curious if you felt the same way.
It was all part of the same thing. Very significant, and the extent to which the Profumo affair rocked the country is probably underestimated. I mean, it really. You know, it changed things a lot, and the Beatles, the advent of the Beatles, probably was very significant. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm.
Cool. Gotcha.
So I love the Beatles. I thought the Beatles. One other reasons I went to write this book. I love the Beatles. You know, I think in fact, a guy called Neil Spencer, who used to be the editor of the Enemy, came over to my place when 9 days ago. And we were both talking about this and saying how the most perfect single, the most perfect 45 ever made was Strawberry Fields Forever, backed with Penny Lane. I don't know if
that's absolutely.
It's the most perfect record ever made, you know, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned.
But it didn't get to number one, did it?
Well, not in the UK, right?
Right.
Yeah. So did you ever get to meet or interview McCartney before you started writing the biography?
No. But you see, I knew, and one of the reasons I wanted to write this was, obviously John Lennon's been killed. And John, this isn't to devalue John in any way at all, but John at that point, early 80s, is the, you know, he's been given sainthood, really.
Right.
Seen as the driving force in the Beatles. He was all the Beatles were, which I knew wasn't the case. You know, I knew from my experience, people I talked to in the music business by then, that actually the driving force in the Beatles was always Paul McCartney. He was the one who kept the whole thing going, you know?
Right.
not in any way to denigrate John, but I felt things were not, it was not correct. What was being said. That was my motivating force in doing the book.
Gotcha. So you weren't able to, so writing the book then, you understood that it was Paul McCartney who was the driving force behind the Beatles, not necessarily John, but John did have a lot of, you know, power earlier on, and it was Paul that really wanted the band to continue. So let's, I mean, starting with the book, you know, how long did it take you to write this?
Let me think. Well, the actual physical, well, you know, books are in two parts because there's the research.
The research, of course.
Right.
And then right. The physical writing. So I would say I did it relatively quickly. Okay. The actual writing, I think, took me about 5 months, maybe. But also, I'd probably spent 6 or 7 months on researching before that and talking to people, going up to Liverpool, for example. You know, I mean, okay. I had quite a lot of interviews for the book.
Got you.
So it's so, it took me about a year.
Okay. Got you. Were you able to interview any?
Well, I was going to ask, what key Liverpool people did you happen to interview when you were researching up that way?
Let me have a look. I can't even remember that, to be honest. I talked to a lot of Paul's teachers, for example.
Oh, okay.
Next door neighbor, Tom Gall, for example. I talked to, I'm just looking in the book actually to try and remember. It's quite a long time ago now. There's a celebrated promoter that I spoke to. I can't remember his name. Let me have a look. I'm just having a Bill Harry I spoke to, obviously.
Obviously, right. Yeah.
Who's the guy?
Bob Wooler or Alan Williams or any of the...
I spoke to Bob Wooler. I mean, I had a kind of, you know, drunken night. Well, he was very drunk, you know, as he often was. And Alan, I also spoke to, but briefly. They were not very helpful. Those guys would be characterized as, they would be described to as kind of old classic Liverpool drunks. And they sort of were a bit. Sam, God. Sorry, I would have should have looked at, you know, Jack Sweeney, his form master, was very good. But what's this Sam guy? Sam, do you know there's a guy called Sam? What's his, he was extremely good. I can picture him.
Was he part of the cavern scene or was he?
Yeah, part of that whole, that era. And I spoke to Dorothy Roan, who's a girlfriend of Paul's. I'm looking for this guy, Sam. Wow. Sam Leach.
Sam Leach, of course, yes.
Yeah, that was it. He was actually very good. And, you know, people like Bob Wooler and Alan Williams were kind of all very disparaging of him. But actually, he had a very good perspective on the whole thing.
Gotcha.
I remember going around and talking to Pete Best's mum briefly.
Mm. Mona,
not being able to find him. But there were, I carved did the kind of, you know, the legwork really up in Liverpool for a week or so.
Sure.
Some of the teachers were very good. Alan Durbant, who was one of his main, Jack Sweeney, Alan Durbant, these were teachers. I'm just looking through the book.
And they had to be towards the end of their career or retired by that point.
Yeah, they were. They were the teachers from the Institute.
From the Institute, right.
Institute, yeah.
Okay. You started off the book with talking about the death of his mother. I mean, was that, you know, one of the more important aspects of writing this book? To I mean, obviously, you started with that. You know, talk about that for a second.
Yeah, well, it was obvious that kind of like, Harold's probably about 12, isn't he, when this happens?
Yeah.
And obviously that's kind of going to be a traumatic experience, you know, and kind of, and it's going to be, it'd be something like that happens to you is going to sky forever, you know.
Sure.
And you know, it's like those lines Mother Mary said to me, let it be, let it, you know, it keeps right. coming back. You know, that's the last thing, that the last Beatles single, really. And also, of course, the fact that John's mother died, you know, when he's, what, 16, isn't he, I think?
Mm-hmm.
This was one of the things that clearly, to me, bound them together, you know?
Right.
They had that shared experience. You know, people didn't have, largely, you know, people's mums and dads didn't really die, you know?
So young and tragic like that,
so
right?
Young and tragically, for both of them. I mean, I felt this was very, very important in bonding them together. And you could, and you know, they had a shared experience of pain.
Right.
Very important, that, I thought, in their relationship.
Right. Another really cool aspect of the book was you did this, Mark Lewisohn ended up doing this for his first volume in his Beatles book. But you traced back the McCartney family some decades.
Yeah. Oh, the lineage, yeah. Went back to about 1880, it looks like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's important. You know, I think, I mean, I read a review of someone was, a journalist was talking about music books, and, oh, the early stuff, I always skip it right over. But to me, it's like that's the roots of the whole thing. I always spend a lot of time on that, because I think then you find out about the not only the person's background, his family, attitudes, it's all kind of comes together if you look at all that. I think it's important to do that.
Gotcha. And now, you know, the book is really Beatle heavy. You know, in the last bit, you know, some solo stuff. I mean, obviously, I mean, you were a big, huge Beatles fan. So, was there? Did you have fun, you know, digging into that? Did you find out stuff that you never knew and you were surprised of Paul during that time? If you can remember,
the Beatles stuff, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, particularly the extent, although it's probably staring me in the face, but the extent to which Paul was like a mover and shaker in swinging London, which the other three Beatles weren't, because they didn't live in London.
Right.
You know, and Paul, you know, he installed himself in really the underground of London before John did, really.
Absolutely.
You know, he's not just he's living in the centre of London. You know, he's involved with Barry Miles, for example, you know, and John Dunbar, the Indica Gallery.
John Page.
He's actually there, painting, decorating it. You know, I mean, that was one of the things I liked about Paul. He just muck in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like he's going to be a star about things. And, you know, even like things like, you know, Got to Get You Into My Life, which was about marijuana. To my astonishment.
Mm-hmm.
And also the extent to which Paul was the propagator for kind of legalization. You know, the advertisement in the Times newspaper in London, June, I think it is, June 67. I mean, which is signed by over 60 dignitaries of all
right,
sorts.
Including the four Beatles and Brian.
And Brian, but it's Paul who pays for that. Paul is the instigator of that entire getting John Hopkins, an attempt to get John Hopkins out of jail. John Hopkins was one of the editors of International Times, which Barry Miles, as I knew him, also was. And, you know, he'd rather unwisely, you know, he'd been busted for the second time for possession of not a large amount of marijuana, but his, in court, instead of actually having a defense, he conducted his defense himself and which was essentially, you know, a pro marijuana rap,
right.
Of course, doesn't go down very well with the jury. But anyway, he gets 9 months, I think it was. And Paul, you know, knew him, and he'd also organised the 14-hour Technicolor Dream, which was at Alexander Palace, which was an important underground event in, it's like, May, I think it's May, end of April, May 67. And, but Paul, you know, was prepared to, you know, put his name, well, put his money
right
behind this ad in the Times. It would have been expensive, but presumably he could afford it. So I kind of like that aspect of him. I, you know, I thought he, and he was, Paul was the one who would come on TV.
Yeah.
I remember talking about, you know, how, you know, marijuana opened up your third eye and, you know, I'd never heard of it. I mean, I'd never heard of your third eye at that point.
It's funny because, you know, you mentioned Got to Get You Into My Life and how it's about the marijuana. And it's funny because I've seen a lot of people write about that on Facebook and stuff and how that song is now ruined for them just because of the whole marijuana aspect of it.
Why? It kind of, that's ridiculous. It kind of celebrates it even more, surely.
Yeah.
Why would they be
Yeah, and then that interview he does about taking acid too, you know, and how it's the reporter's responsibility to not report it, but he's
not report
tell
it.
About it because he wants to be honest, you know.
Yeah, I felt he was honest about all this as well, you know.
Yeah, he didn't hide it for sure.
Well, one of the things that I know that kind of cheesed off the other Beatles was the fact that he was one of the last ones to even dip his toe into the water with the drugs, and now he's on the television talking about it like an expert.
But that's Paul, you know, he's the Gemini communicator. You know, that's what he always was. He is, you know what I mean? It's like, he was described somewhat sarcastically as though the PR man of the group, but it's not. That's just his natural forte, you know? He would probably have been quite good as a journalist himself, you know? I mean, he did English, he passed English literature at A-level at school.
Right.
But he is the natural communicator. That's one of the things about Paul. That's why he's the, you know...
He's the great PR man.
Top, but he's right. Also... He's a great PR man, you know? And it's pretty... And whereas a lot of PR men are not particularly honest, some anyway...
Right.
You know... Paul was honest, perhaps too honest for his own good.
Right.
Know? And I like, but you know, I thought it was, and also, listen, people, also another reason I wanted to write this, like during the 70s, people like the serious critics, like some I worked with, are all hating everything he does.
Yep.
And, you know, deifying everything John does. And I knew this was absolute nonsense.
Crap.
I mean, obviously, Band on the Run is a fantastic album. There's loads of fantastic stuff. You know, Maybe I'm Amazed. Magnificent. You know, and
right.
I'd seen that show. I saw the show that I was in Los Angeles in 76.
Oh, wow.
When he did that big, you know, the big tour with Wings.
Right. Wings
and
over America.
Although it was at the Forum, I remember.
Yes.
Although, you know, I had doubts about some of it, it was pretty fantastic, you know. It was pretty fantastic.
Yeah, well, the bias against McCartney in the press, especially in the UK and in America, was just largely unfair and rooted in the breakup of the Beatles and vilifying him as the villain.
Exactly.
For breaking it up. And they did not view his work fairly as they did with John, and that I think that's one of the greatest crimes really over the last 50 years of his career. Now it's fashionable to say that this music is great.
Oh,
but back then
real.
They didn't.
It was like I'd left the NME and I kind of felt that it had become very pretentious at times, to be honest, and almost subconsciously I've now realized writing that book was a way of stating, this is all behind me. I'm not interested in, you know, in your sort of petty little tribal wars.
Okay.
And, you know, there is someone I know, I won't say his name, who when I wrote the McCartney book, it came out, sort of sneered at me saying, writing, how could you spend all that time writing a book about such a boring person? You know, take a running jump, really. You know, have a look at yourself, please. Come on. know, wonderful. And there was a, because there was, there certainly was a tray in the NME to kind of just sneer at everyone. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to get the cheap laugh, you know, to sneer and get the cheap laugh. But, you know, there certainly was a time in my life when I, you know, very quickly I thought, no, this is the, it's exactly that. It's the cheap laugh and it's not going to enhance you or anyone in any way. And actually, I remember being in the yard, the studio yard of Lee Scratch Perry, who, of course, had worked with Paul in Jamaica. And being saying, positive, man, you have to be positive, positive. And I remember thinking, oh, that sounds a good idea. I think I'll be that, you know, instead of being, you know, the cynical little hack, you know. I'd rather be that. It seems a better idea to me. So that's another reason that I wanted to write the book, because I just knew it was ridiculous the way Paul had been treated. And I know when my name was put up to do the interview for that first edition of Q.
We're going to talk about Paul, that next.
The PR guy, whoever the PR guy was doing Paul, Tony Brainsby, was it? I can't remember. Because it wasn't said to me, it said to Mark Allen, the editor. Mark said, oh, he's written a book about Paul, you know. And he was very nervous because all anyone did was slag Paul off.
Right.
And so Mark had read the book. Mark had read the book. Says no, it's not that at all. You know.
So the book was out then, prior to you interviewing Paul McCartney for the Q.
By about a second.
Okay.
Probably maybe not even out. You know, but there were copies. There were review copies perhaps around. I think it's, you know, it's about the same time the Q interview.
Right. So then now the you know, the message is getting relayed to Paul that this is a more favorable bio on him than before the interview.
Hmm. Apparently.
Right. So now let's talk about this first, that interview. Now this is specifically for the launch of Q Magazine, for this interview?
Yeah.
I know it's been a long time, so if you can remember.
I can't remember too much, man.
Right. But early on in the interview, you talk about how you liked his latest album, Press to Play. And all of a sudden, it just seemed like after that, he was just willing to pour his heart out to you. But do you remember Press to Play? And you remember liking it?
Yeah. And I'd actually been to see him do. Maybe he wanted to check me out or something. But a few days before, he'd been doing something at the BBC with regard to it.
Okay.
And I'd been there, and I'd been up there, and I introduced myself afterwards. But you know what I noted about that interview? He's just like straight into it,
right?
I mean, straight into it. You know, there's no faffing around. Would you like a cup of tea or anything? It's in his offices in Soho Square,
right.
And very tasteful, as you would expect. And we're just like straight into it. It's like a rap, you know.
Right. It just seemed like it was, you weren't even really trying to get all this information out of him. He was just pouring it out. You know, so did he know that this was being recorded?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, it's just the fact that he's just so open, and then being recorded, you would think maybe he would, you know, speak a little more carefully, you know, while you're being recorded.
He was great. He was great.
No, I mean, this interview is excellent. It also reminds me of another one from 1980, the McCartney interview with Vic Garbarini for the Musician magazine.
Okay, Vic's a friend of mine, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I've had the opportunity to talk to Vic about this. And I mean, again, you know, he was just like really, you know, he had a game plan of what he wanted to do, but he was surprised with just how you know, much he was just letting go. Letting his guard down, really.
I know. I was I was going to say, I was surprised. I wasn't really, because it seemed a very natural situation. It was just very conversational. It was just like, you know, he could have been any music. He wasn't like, this is a superstar, Paul McCartney.
No, very down to earth.
And I tended not to see things like that anyway, because it doesn't help, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I would always try not to be impressed with situations like that.
Right.
Professionally, you know what I mean? It makes it easier if you're not. But with him, I didn't even have to think like that. It was just like, I remember he just came into the room and straight away sits down like, boom, 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 boom. Straight away.
Right.
Excellent.
Excellent.
And made me really like him, obviously.
Uh-huh. That's great. I mean, things that I was really surprised at. I mean, he seemed aware of of knowing what he did to piss the other three off. I mean, he seemed aware that, you know, breaking or announcing the Beatles breakup was going to piss off with John. He knew, you know, pissing off George by not letting him, you know, play guitar on between every verse of Hey Jude, and, you know, pissing off Ringo for playing Back to the USSR. I mean, he just seemed so aware, you know, of this stuff. And then talking so candid about Yoko too. I mean, one of the things that the stories about that he tells during your interview is about, you know, her wanting to see him, but then she was ended up being too busy to see him. That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah, I mean,
then,
I think he was just completely candid, and I think he was. But Paul's a really perceptive bloke. You know, he would have seen what was going on with the other Beatles, you know, how difficult it was working with them.
Right.
I will say this. You know, I interviewed Paul, no, George. I interviewed George about 3 years later.
Okay.
And I was surprised at how sort of, you know, he just seemed a bit small-minded, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of sarcastic and a bit bitter, actually.
Yeah, but right. George always kind of was, you know, he always was very bitter in those he seemed very bitter there for a period there in the 1980s.
I mean, it's like, come on, get over it, man. Like, you know what I mean, that was the period. I can't remember if he said this to me, but like, oh, I'd rather not have been in the Beatles. That's the way you think he's thinking.
Come
but,
on.
You know,
right.
Get over it, man.
Get over it.
I mean, you know what? It's better than being whatever you're going to be in Liverpool, electrician in Liverpool, come off it, you know. Sarcastic and a little bit snide and petty. I was actually very disappointed.
Right.
Encountering right. With George.
That's disappointing, really.
You know, because I thought they're all great, you know.
Right.
This one didn't seem so good. You know?
The other cool thing in this interview too is talking to him about the whole, you know, it's a drag comment, for, you know, after the death of Lennon, and how you're, you know, pretty much understanding what he meant by that.
Yeah,
and he totally felt comfortable with that with you.
This is understatement. It's classic understatement. It's also probably very English in a way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not wanting to kind of bear your heart on your sleeve. I mean,
it's the same as
the remarks about his mum, you know, where he's supposed to said, you know, what are we going to do without our money?
It's right.
Like, this is not an indication that this is someone who is a hugely materialistic person.
It's no.
Just someone, a child in trauma, you know, saying, mm-hmm. you know, trying saying, that awkward thing that kids in such a state say, you know?
And I think a lot of this, too, is a lot gets lost in translation between American and English vernacular. People, what's accepted in print in England, people in America just sometimes take it and run with it because
listen, in England, they don't get it either. You know what I mean? In
right.
England, they don't get it either. It's not just, I don't think it's just a transatlantic misunderstanding. A lot of people in this country wouldn't get it also, but I was just trying to look a bit deeper into it. I'm not kind of right. like bigging myself up in any way that way, but I just trying to see what's he really saying here. It's a drag. Yeah, that's classic understatement, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not like I don't care, which is sort of what it was translated as being by some people, obviously.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware of, so how does this come out on I would imagine it's a bootleg picture disc. I mean, how were you aware of this happening?
I can't remember what happened actually.
Okay. Well, you recorded it obviously with your own equipment, and then at some
I think someone may have bought it from me. I probably shouldn't have sold it. I don't know.
Okay.
I knew this was going to happen. I think there was someone who was buying interview cassettes, and I'd sold them two or three.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't seem, and I don't think I knew what was going on at the time. I remember it was a very fast-paced in my life at that point.
Yeah, I read that MPL tried to block the release of this picture disc. Do you know if that's accurate or true?
I've never even seen this. You know, is it a picture disc?
Yeah,
it is.
We can want to turn on the camera real quick. I can show him.
Yeah, I'll just turn your camera on, Tom. Hold on.
Wait, okay. I've never seen it.
Yeah. Hold on. Go ahead, Tom. Start your enable your video. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So, can you see Chris?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's one side.
Oh wow!
And then
okay,
there's the other side.
Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, okay. So this is up on YouTube. Friend of the show, Adrian, he posted this up on YouTube about 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
So, I mean, it can be
I'll have to have a listen. I'll have to listen.
Yeah, we'll pass the link. We'll pass the link on to you. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I really can't remember the details, but I do remember running into Paul, you know, a few years later and saying, look, if any, you know, nonsense went on over that, I apologize. I don't think I realized what was going on. You know, I didn't know they tried to stop its release, by the way.
Right.
And he was, of course, Paul was cool and handed me a spliff. You know what I mean? as he would, really.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like after this interview, he was never really, you know, as candid.
No.
Before, you know, or, you know, since then. I mean, you know, I would imagine that, you know, maybe then after this or after the release of this interview, maybe he started to, you know, bring his guard down a little bit and you know, just seemed to be more careful with what he says after that, you know.
I'm not sure. I've always enjoyed, I generally enjoy reading Paul McCartney interviews or seeing him being interviewed, but I think he was responding to the book, you know.
Gotcha.
That it was kind of, because it kind of has reached, you know, you know, it's like Hitler, my part in his downfall. I'm not trying to make my, you know, my role too large in this, but my part of my intention was to state that it wasn't quite accurate what was being said about his position. Right. You know?
I think that's great. It needed to be said. You know, he can't fight that war himself, you know.
That's what I thought I could, you know, the various levels of why you're writing a book, but that was kind of like the sort of the central thrust. I know I have a story here, you know,
right,
that is not being said.
Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people at that time weren't aware of his like involvement, of, you know, the flutes, you know, the, whatchamacallit on Strawberry Fields, the Mellotron, right? Is that what it's called, Andy?
Yes. The Mellotron. Yeah.
Mellotron. I mean, people weren't aware of how involved he was in songs like A Day in the Life or doing the tape loops for Tomorrow Never Knows. I mean, a lot of this just stuff just came out after the fact, you know, and he wasn't defending himself at all, really.
I mean, the fact is Paul is a consummate artist, you know, just as much as, you know, John is seeing as, oh, the artist Beatle, you know, but Paul is just as much an artist.
Absolutely.
Just as much. Paul was, you know, I mean, when the Quarrymen then he became Johnny the Moondogs. I mean, Paul would be designing the posters, not John.
Right.
You know, because he'd done A-level art. In fact, he had a higher grade in art than John did, actually.
Yeah.
You talked about meeting Paul after this. Were you able to interview him again after this?
I didn't sort of want to, really, you know.
Okay.
I mean, I suppose I could have done that, you know, but I mean, there are a lot of people who've, a lot of journalists, music journalists, kind of keep interviewing the same person, you know?
Right.
And largely speaking, I didn't do that because to me, it's like I was looking for the kind of, you know, the story is there, you know.
Right.
And then, but I've done that. Right. I don't want to do that again, largely.
Right.
You know, and you know, that time I ran into him, it was at a, I think it was Wayne's World premiere party. It was at the Hard Rock Cafe in London.
Okay.
Was there a Wayne's World? There was a Wayne's World 2, wasn't there?
Right. Yep, there was.
Was there a Wayne's?
Yep.
I think it was Wayne's World 2, actually.
Uh-huh.
And I just had a great time with it. You know what I mean? I went up and introduced, you know, said, "Hey, I'm Chris Sanders. I haven't seen you for 10 years, blah, blah, blah."
Right.
Linda, I know, just Linda tried to stand in front of him as though that was her job to protect him, you know?
Right.
But then when I said my name, she was sort of stepped back.
Okay.
And then we went and sat down at a table and, you know, had a ting and ting, as we say.
Right. Do you recall who came in at the end of the interview to Paul? And Paul's like, "Well, okay, well, I guess we did have gone a bit long." Do you recall who that was that came in the office?
No, not a clue.
Okay. Well, it's a fascinating interview. I think you did a splendid job. I mean, did you have any game plan going in on that interview? I mean, did you have a bunch of questions? I'm sure I did.
No. I would prepare.
Right.
I'm quite good at preparing for interviews. I mean, I don't do so many these days, but you know, I would have had a notebook with questions with me. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Gotcha.
But I think that he kind of controlled it with just what he. I think he just started. I can't remember what the first thing he said to me was, but he just kind of took. He sort of took the lead. It's like, this is what I want to say almost, you know?
Right.
He might have just been in the mood to say, you know what, I'm feeling kind of open today, and this is what I'm going to say.
It was a great day, you know, I remember that. He's right. Like, very up. It was like, you know, his energy seemed very positive.
Right. He talks about it, and he talks about how he was working on a remix for one of the singles on Press to Play at the beginning of your interview. You know, which is pretty, you know, so he was obviously feeling very up and productive. And, you know, obviously we know that the critical panning of Press to Play was going to come, which wasn't great. But, I mean, he was in the middle of the, you know, promoting his album. So he was in good spirits.
Yeah. No, it was like, it was a great day. He had great energy. You know, it seemed like we were quite simpatico. I suppose we would be. I've been studying him for the last 2 years or so. I mean,
you know,
I was primed.
Right. One of the things that you talked to him about in the interview, which, you know, I'm kind of fascinated by, because sometimes it's hard to ask like a tough question because you don't know what kind of reaction you're going to get. But you asked him something about, you know, about Yoko still being on methadone. Or methadone, however you pronounce it. I mean, is questions like that, like tough questions, that like easy for you to do?
I just thought it was part of the job, really.
Yeah.
To be honest. I mean, they're not that hard, no.
Okay.
Because that's the question, isn't it? You know?
Right, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That's the sort of gig. You're supposed to be finding things out.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
One of my favorite parts of the entire interview is him talking about how, you know, he really was the one that kind of spoke to Yoko and John about getting them back together again, and then how he candidly tells you, well, you're not going to see that printed anywhere because they don't want that out there. But there he is telling you, you know, in person, this is, you know, Yoko came to see me, I went to go see John, and, you know, and then boom, they're back together. And then, of course, officially, that's not what got told, but, and he tells you, hey, you're not going to see that printed anywhere.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Yeah. So obviously we got the announcement a few months back about Q Magazine shutting down.
About 6 weeks, about a month ago, isn't it, almost?
Yeah, well, it seemed like a couple. Maybe time's just going by quicker for me
It was just now. I think it's about a month, actually.
Yeah. I mean, talk about your involvement with Q. I mean, how much other stuff did you do for Q Magazine?
Well, I worked on the first few editions, largely. Because I then went to work on MTV Europe, which set up. I had a show on MTV Europe.
Okay.
And but I knew, the person I knew there, well, it was two editors, Mark Ellen and David Hepworth. And I'd always thought that Mark was very talented and he'd done stuff for the NME. And I'd always tried to get him, you know, I was commissioning stuff, a little bit of stuff. I would always get him to write stuff. And I thought he was talented, but hadn't fit in. You know, I think someone said, well, Mark Allen didn't have the right haircut for the NME. But I knew he was talented. And I liked his energy and he was funny. Which is things something that I always appreciate about people. So I thought this, and also I could tell the days, you know, that's one of the reasons I'd left the NME. You could feel its time was over, you know, that right. already the Face had started. One of the reasons I left the NME was because I started to do stuff for the Face magazine. And one of the editors at the NME told me, oh, you can't write for us if you're doing stuff for that. So, okay, fuck off, you know. it was a new time. It was the '80s. And I liked, you know, as I said, I mentioned, I knew Vic Garbarini and I liked those American magazines like Musician, which seemed to have a larger, but you know, larger agenda of what you could write about, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone says that Q's success was built on, you know, the arrival of the CD market. I probably that's the case, but I wasn't really aware of that. And it just seemed like it was I liked the shape of it, you know, the design and the content. And it was relatively intelligent, you know, it was quite intelligent. And was quite funny as well, you know.
Right.
So I think that's why it was obvious why it was going to be successful. And, you know, again, I can remember sort of, you know, again, I won't mention his name, but, you know, a PR guy in a record company who considered himself very hip, always a kiss of death, you know, always a warning, who remember saying, well, I can't imagine who's going to read this. And I think quite a bloody obvious, mate. There's a market waiting there for it, you know? It's way, you know, because, you know, the people, I'm sorry, you know, the NME was too much about, it seemed to me too much about shoegazing, you know, kind of Manchester groups in overcoats, which just weren't very interesting. But there was lots of other interesting stuff going on out there, always, you know. And I had a lot of respect for Q. I thought it was a good idea. I'm sorry, and I'm very sorry to hear it's gone under. Although I can't pretend to have read an issue cover to cover for some years, I must admit.
Do you remember? So you pretty much just worked on the initial first couple episodes, and that was it.
I did a big piece.
Or issues, sorry.
Issues. I did a big piece similar to the Paul interview with Elton John.
Oh, cool.
Which I remember I went to LA to do that. That's probably about three episodes later. I did a bit of stuff. I mean, for example, in that first edition, I have not only the McCartney, because they'd have two or three images on the front cover. So I did the Macca interview, but I also did Big Audio Dynamite, second album, produced by Joe, you know, co-produced by Joe Strummer, back writing songs, Will the Clash Get Back Together? You know, I did those two stories in the first one.
Gotcha. And so afterwards, I mean, come the 80s, I mean, you're goal is more biographies and books at the time, though. So is that your more of your thought process is to switching over to books?
Yeah, it was really, because I could tell I had that time with, I had a couple of years at MTV where I had a film program called Kino, K-I-N-O,
right,
which was great. But it made me step away from journalism. And I did a bit of, you know, I did the after the MTV gig ends, because you know they were cutting costs and my program cost the most of anyone to make and I had the best deal anyway. but then I did things like, you know, I did the El Salvador Civil War, for example, for the Sunday Correspondent, and I was and met a couple of medical stories in Africa and China. I was kind of, you know, those papers were declining, and the Sunday Correspondent, for which I did those stories, just went under suddenly. I could sniff the wind, you know, of what we see happening now. Really, I could tell something was going to go wrong with print journalism. You know, I didn't know what it was, but I could tell, because I knew that, for example, in the 1980s, about the middle of the decade, the marketing men and accountants seemed to take over.
Okay.
You know, on say the daily newspapers, Sunday newspapers. And I was uncomfortable about the way it was going. And so I decided, and I was trying to write film scripts as well, which I did do. I was a Chris Blackwell, who started Island Records, his house with a guy called Don Letts, who was in fact been in Big Audio Dynamite in 1994. And he said, I've got a really good idea. We're sitting out on the lawn, you know, in the summer. I've got a good idea. We always talk about Jamaica as being a natural film set, which we had talked. Why don't you two go down there and see if we can start a low-budget film industry? So we thought, well, that's a terrible idea. Why on earth would I want to do that? So we did do that, and we got a couple of films out of it. Don directed a film called Dance Hall Queen, and I co-wrote this film called Third World Cop, which was a huge hit, you know, in the Caribbean and the black market as well. And so I've done a bit of that ever since. You know, I was doing a lot of these things just fall to bits, though. You know, films is tricky. But, you know, I was doing The Harder They Come 2 at one point.
A sequel to The Harder They Come?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Because I like that movie. I mean, I'm not the biggest reggae fan, but I actually enjoy the... with Jimmy Cliff. I actually enjoy that film.
Fantastic film. I was doing a Peter Tosh biopic at one point. All these things fall into black holes. It's
right.
Easy for things to fall back. But I've done quite a lot of things like that. So I was trying to, I thought I'd do books. I remember I sat on a beach in Sydney, Australia, having a slight crisis about this. All these newspapers, I'd also worked on a Time Out. The Sunday Correspondent went under, and I'd also worked on, and was about to be made editor of this Time Out subsidiary magazine, an arts magazine, a monthly arts magazine called 2020.
Okay.
And which, funnily enough, we seem to be in that year now, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A year where we have no clarity of vision whatsoever.
No, none.
That had gone, you know, I go on holiday, I'm coming back to be the editor. Oh, it's folded. Okay, because it's that recession. And so I sat on this beach in Sydney, and I thought, what am I going to do? You know, I think I've written a couple of books, three books by that time, because I'd also done one with Billy Bragg, where we'd done a tour of the Soviet Union.
Oh, wow.
Which was a fairly amazing experience, actually, at the time of the peak of perestroika. So it's like, this was November, December 87. So I'd done three books at that point. I thought, well, I can do this. I seem to be okay at this. And I quite like doing it as well, you know. It's a bit of a lonely gig. But I thought, I can do this, and I can do the film thing, I think, at that point, which I did manage. That's what I want to do. And I'll occasionally write articles. I didn't want to... Look, I guess towards the end of the NME, or the end of, you know, maybe The Face or something, but early 80s, I remember interviewing... Might have been one of Duran, actually. thinking, I shouldn't be interviewing you. You should be interviewing me, because I know lots more than you. I know lots more than you. So it just seemed pointless, you know.
Right.
Why, you know, they're kids, you know.
Right.
So why should they know a lot? But I'm wasting my time here, you know. And so... You know, I worked on the Sunday Times magazine, where I would write I'd write stuff about, you know, housing projects in Scotland, or time out and wrote things as sleuth sniffing gangs. I was doing more interesting stuff, I thought, really, you know?
Right, right.
And I didn't really want to go and interview too many musicians, actually. Oh, occasionally I would, you know?
Right.
But they'd have to interest me very much.
Yeah. Gotcha. Chris, going back to the book, really, just on talking about the different issues, and I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but, I mean, Tom's got an issue with the book. I think it's a hardcover. I have a soft cover with an alternative cover. Were you kind of given any input on artwork or design or anything like that?
No, I wasn't at all, actually. I mean, I was very new to it then. Now I would have had, you know, but I thought the hardback St. Martin's Press cover was really good.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got that. He's got like a pink shirt on.
Yeah. I thought that was really good.
Yeah, I was just curious if you as the author would be consulted on that, which, you know, it's a pity you weren't, but those decisions were kind of taken out of your hand.
Nowadays, I would know how to do that, but then I didn't really.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But actually, I thought the St. Martin's cover was really good.
It's a nice touch, that cover. It really is.
You know, yeah. Sometimes people come up with stuff you don't expect. For example, my Jimmy Page biography, which is like my most recent book.
Right.
I've just got the Japanese edition.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic. It's fantastic.
The cover.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it looks. See if you can find it online. It's pink. You know, Jimmy Page playing a pink suit. But also there's Japanese kind of text all over it. And actually, the McCartney book came out in Japan as well. I can't remember what the cover is. And what else has come out? Bob Marley.
Right. And you did one on one of the members of the Clash, too. Was it Strummer?
Joe Strummer, that came out in Japan.
Can you talk a little bit about the business end? Go ahead.
Of what? How do you mean?
So you write these books. Do you get like an advance and afterwards? Or, I mean, are you making money on the sales of the book as well?
Yeah. That's basically what's supposed to happen.
Anyway. Well, so you just never know how publishing goes and stuff, but it's nice to see if you can make a few quid from it.
No. I mean, the advances aren't as good as they used to be. I will tell you that.
Yeah.
So I didn't know if it was kind of like a musician when they get publishing rights, that they keep on making money, you know, when like songs are played on the radio or whatnot. And I just didn't know if there was something like that for writers as well, like for, you know, copies sold or especially when there's another pressing of the book.
No. You keep going, basically. I mean, so long as you've paid off your advance.
Okay. Gotcha.
You know, which hopefully gotcha. You will.
Gotcha.
You know? I mean, right.
So
sometimes it's worth doing a deal without much of an advance, knowing that you'll get royalties straight away virtually.
Cool. Okay. Gotcha. That's good to know. What are you working on anything now?
Yeah, I am, but I don't want to tell you about it.
Yes.
All right. Well, listen, when the time is right, tell us and we'll push it for you.
So are you still enjoying writing?
Yeah, of course. That's what I do, basically.
Right.
Yeah. That's what I do. There's a couple of things I'm working on at the moment, but I can't. I'm superstitious. I think you can talk stuff out, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
You don't, and then you've talked about it enough, and you don't have to write it down. I've talked to everyone about it. So
right.
I can't really talk about things until I've...
No, that's understandable. I mean, I was just trying to see if there was anything we could help you plug at the moment.
No. I'll let you know. I'll certainly let you know. Thanks very much. Where are you guys, by the way?
Go ahead, Andy.
I'm in New Jersey, about 30 minutes from New York City, so I'm on the East Coast.
Okay.
I'm in Phoenix, Arizona, so I'm on the West Coast.
Oh, right, over there. Okay, wow, so it's quite early for you.
Yeah, but that's fine. I'm usually up early anyway, so...
But, good, me too. The early bird gets the worm.
Yeah, that's what they say.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, Chris, for your time. This was really enjoyable. I mean, you answered a lot, For me, there wasn't really a lot known about, you know, the behind the scenes for the book and the interview you did. So thank you for answering these questions.
Thank you. It's not every day that two Yanks can talk to a gentleman who, you know, have met Paul McCartney and George Harrison. So thank you.
I met Ringo as well, actually.
Oh, great.
Thanks. Well, even better.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. Thanks so much, guys. You know, thanks yes. very much indeed.
And Chris, we'll send you this when this is all done and published and edited. We'll send you the link so you can watch it and listen to it. And I'll also send you the link to the video which has your interview with Paul on it as well. I'll send you that as well.
Yeah. Thanks very much indeed. I would love to hear that. I'd love to hear that.
Will do. Will do. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Great. Thanks. Have a lovely day.
You too, well, Chris. Bye now.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.
You guys enjoy it. Bye.
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 All right. And that was our interview with Chris Selavik. I got to make sure I say that right because, you know, I was up, the night before.
I always thought it was Salowitz, but okay.
Yeah. So I was up the night before looking up interviews with him on YouTube. And everybody was just screwing up his name.
Butchering the name? Yeah.
Butchering the name, kind of like, they do with my name.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but man, damn it. But that was great. I mean, I went in not expecting him to remember everything because, you know, this happened
over 30 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I still think it's important to, you know, interview those people too.
Presents
itself, you know, because, yeah, I mean, like you said, you know, before we hung up, I mean, it's not every day you get to, talk to somebody that actually got to, you know, interview McCartney.
Yeah, it doesn't happen every day. You get to get interview people that, you know, have met three Beatles. I mean, that's pretty significant. That's pretty cool. So he's a good guy, and that was a good score for us. So it was a good show.
Yeah, I think so too. I think hopefully everybody will appreciate for what it is. And,
If you haven't gotten his book, I'm sure you can get it secondhand pretty cheap. Tom mentioned, it is very Beatle heavy. You know, it's probably 80% Beatles. 20% solo, which has been a gripe of ours with McCartney books, and that's going to be a future show for us in a few weeks. We're going to do a show just on McCartney books, and we'll see how the landscape of McCartney books has changed, or how it started mm-hmm. and how it's gone now. So, but again, this is an early pioneer of his biography. It's a good one, and again, as you pointed out, he covers the early, and again, obviously, that was interesting to me. The Liverpool aspect, and he covers the McCartney genealogy very well, not to the Lewison extent, but that's, you know.
Yeah, no, and that was huge. I mean, I would think that Lewison maybe, you know, got the idea from this sub-book. So, I mean, it's definitely possible.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's a great aspect, and like you said, I mean, it's a great way to understand, you know, the person and their history.
The lineage, yeah, sure.
Yeah, exactly. So great. Another good one. Thank you, Andy. We're going to talk about where we are and everything. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Two Legs Podcast. You can email us at twolegspodcast@gmail.com. Please check us out on YouTube. That's Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. If you like what you see, please subscribe. We're picking up, seems like we're picking up more and more subscribers every day. So thank you for that. We love the comments. We always look at the comments and we try to, you know, respond when we can. So in that aspect, please keep those coming. The emails are great as well. So thank you very much. What else is there? You know, Spotify. But
not yet. We're going to look
into that. iTunes, iHeartRadio, we're there. Yeah, we're looking into that. And then, you know, obviously, we got a lot to come. Next week, we're going to record again. We've got a returning guest, Ted Montgomery, coming on. And we're going to talk about that they did together throughout the 70s, and that should be another good time.
Yeah, good shows coming out on the pipeline and then taking us well through August and into September.
Yeah, we got hopefully a surprise crossover in the works come September. We got a lot of good shows, a lot of discoveries that have been popping up that we're going to be talking about as well. I'm sure at some point we want to get into that McCartney interview from British GQ. I mean, there's some interesting stuff on there that
yeah.
we can talk about.
Yeah, we can touch upon that maybe in a news yeah. segment or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, we'll check that out too. So, actually, Andy, anything you want to add before we sign off?
No. Thanks again for everybody tuning in and the comments and the YouTube channel. I think we're up to 162 subscribers. So please keep on. We want to get to that 200 magic number. So right, keep going.
Right. Keep going. Thank you. Okay. So everybody out there, thank you again. Take care. As always, have a great day and a beautiful night. See ya.
You've been listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan C.